You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
What's up?
Not a whole lot, you know, just enjoying some exciting times in the NBA playoffs. Been quite the unpredictable year so far.
Yeah, a lot of teams that have either never won championships or have not won championships in at least our lifetimes and been quite a while. So it's pretty fun to see. I mean, we see on one end, you know, you got the Phoenix Suns, who have never won a title, even though they've made it pretty far a few times. And then we're still in the final stages here of the Eastern Conference Finals, and those are two teams that they last won it in the 70s and then the 50s or whatever. So it's kind of right. Cool. It's kind of cool that there's some new blood in there for the first time. And I saw some amazing stat too. I don't know if you saw this, that this is the first NBA Finals since 1983 that does not feature a former Shaquille O'Neal teammate, which just like, I saw it like 10 minutes before we record, and I'm like, man, I gotta find out. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole just yet, but at some point over this weekend I'm gonna go in and explore that, because that sounds incredible, and I'm very curious what that link and that chain is of those guys from 1983 all the way to 2020, who you could call.
Right. Well, you got Byron Scott, probably the one who goes back to 84.
That's probably it. I was thinking that seems like the most likely one, because it had to be at least one of those guys on those old Orlando teams. So yeah, Byron Scott seems like the easy pick there. And then I was racking my brain about the 2020 guy. Like I don't know. It's somewhat. Well, I guess LeBron, right? Yeah, LeBron.
Oh, well, yeah, right.
Exactly. It is easy to forget gigantic Shaq playing for the Cleveland Cavaliers, but I guess that didn't happen.
You don't remember, you don't remember the Cavs,
Oh, God. Well, I guess that was easier than I thought. Prior to today, I had forgotten that gigantic man also named Shaquille O'Neal played for the Cleveland Cavaliers. No, not entirely sure if it's the same Shaquille O'Neal, I guess. Yeah. You know, reports are that it is, but I don't know.
Could have been two. Maybe he got swapped.
Because there was like the Celtics. There was the Celtics Shaq too. And like, who was that guy? That wasn't the same guy.
I don't think so. Yeah. And this TNT Shaq, I don't even know what.
Yeah, right. That Boston Shaq had like a weird number. And clearly not the same guy. So
clearly not. Yeah. All right.
Going on here. Some AI Westworld stuff going on.
Right. Let's dive in that one later.
Our next episode will be the deep fakes.
NBA deep fakes. Yes.
The late stage weird Shaquille O'Neal thing.
Exactly. So we are continuing. This is part two of our look at buzzer beaters that won a playoff series. Our last show, we looked at ones that happened in the first round. Now we're going to do ones that happened in the later round, second round, or conference finals. Let's just get right into it. The first one is Tom Heinsohn in the 1960 Eastern Division semifinals, or game six. The Boston Celtics defeating the Philadelphia Warriors. This year was actually on paper the best Celtics season. They were finished 59-16. They'd of course won two of the last three titles, after Bill Russell and Heinsohn, and also an important player, especially in those early days, joined the team in 57. This year they had tied the league record, winning 17 in a row. The 60 Celtics, familiar names by now. You've talked about them a lot on the show, but Russell, Bob Cousy, Frank Ramsey, Bo Scharman, Sam Jones, Casey Jones, Gene Conley are kind of the key guys on this roster. And they'd actually had the third best win-loss percentage in NBA BAA history at this point. They're just slightly behind the 47 Washington Capitals, also coached by Red Auerbach, and the 1950 Syracuse Nationals. Actually, they're one of only 28 teams, if you look at BAA, NBA, or ABA history, that had a win-loss percentage better than 780. So, you know, again, fairly elite, yeah. One iteration of, you know, of course, the 11 championships in 13 seasons already elite dynasty of the Celtics. And Warriors, you know, no slouches either. This is actually Will Chamberlain's rookie year. They finished 49-26. They were coached by Neil Johnston, who was, you know, big 50 star for the Warriors. They still had, Paul Arizin, who was, you know, had led the league in scoring, one of the great stars of the 50s, getting older. But, him and Tom Gola, Joe Grabowski, you know, were kind of holdovers from the 1956 title team. So they, you know, good roster, plus, Guy Rogers, one of the great point guards of his era, Woody Salisbury and Andy Johnson, you know, kind of the key guys there. So, yeah, and this was a tip-in by Heinsohn. It was a tip-in of a Bill Sharman miss at the buzzer, sending the Celtics to victory, of course, here. A pretty tight six-game series, this being the first Russell versus Chamberlain playoff battle, obviously Chamberlain being a rookie. Game six, Russell finished with 25 points, 25 rebounds. Chamberlain had 26 points, 24 rebounds. So pretty even there in the individual matchup. Yeah.
I'd say, unfortunately, right. Chamberlain learns very early on the what this rivalry is going to be like here. As he,
right.
You know, yes. Matches Bill Russell blow for blow. One more point than Russell and a buzzer beater defeat. Agony. Celtics win. Warriors don't. Yeah, it's get used to this, buddy. It's going to happen, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Quite a few more times. So.
There you go. Yeah, and Heinsohn is 22 points in this game, 7 rebounds. He told the Saturday Evening Post that the game winner was the biggest thrill I've had from basketball. 2018 interview he did with Celtic Nation, he says, you know, that was one of my more memorable games. That's the only time that anybody has ever shut up 11,000 Philadelphians all at once.
Yes.
Yes.
I love it.
The convention hall went deathly silent was the way he described it. He also described convention hall as a snake pit and said that shutting the fans up was a great feeling because they've been riding him all year in Philly. In game two, Wilt had actually injured his hand after Heinsohn had been, we'll get into the story here, but yeah, basically he'd been antagonizing Wilt by getting in his way after the free throws, allowing Russell to beat him down the floor for easy baskets. Well, getting frustrated this. And there's a story that Heinsohn tells here. It's kind of a long story, kind of a long quote. Okay. So should I try the Tom Heinsohn voice or should I do it my own voice?
Oh, man. If you can do it, go for it. But it's a tough voice. Right. So if you can do it, I think you should try.
I could do the gravelly part. I'm not sure I'm going to pull off the Boston accent, but I'm going to go with it anyway. So,
okay, go for it. Yeah.
All right. Wilt was a force to be reckoned with, and he took an immediate dislike to me during his rookie in the league. He ripped off my jersey during one game in which we had a little altercation. We had a little play that he used to help us beat Philadelphia all the time because Wilt got a little lazy at times. They would shoot a free throw and make it, and Russell would run down the floor. Cousy would inbound the ball real fast, and Russell would outrun Wilt easily, and Russell would get a layup. All right, that's going to be tough.
I was looking at the paragraph. I'm like, man, all right.
I'm gonna finish it in my own voice. All right, so
you're gonna have a rough rest of the day if you read the rest of this paragraph.
I'm gonna settle that down. All right, so
back to Jason now, right? This is me.
Yes. Okay. So basically, I'm going to sum it up more rather than read because it's a bit long. So anyway, basically what was happening was, you know, they were getting easy baskets off of this. They were doing it during the season. They get to the series and, you know, Wilt is caught on. So Red tells Heinsohn's like, it's not really working anymore. So basically you just got to step in and block out the shooter once the ball goes through and then go pick off Chamberlain so Russell get the step on him. And, Wilt is really he's just like, you do that one more time, I'm going to knock you on your ass. And then Heinz like, I can't really back down from him, even though I don't want him to punch me. So he looked him in the eye and said, bring your lunch. So basically, eventually, Heinsohn sets the pick. And sure enough, Wilt knocks him down. And then he goes after him, winds up and punches him. And then he accidentally punches Tom Gola in the hands. So I'm not exactly sure if he broke it or if he just injured his hand, but anyway, the so you know, that happens in game two, I guess, and then later on in the series, it happens again in Boston, and then basically Heinsohn tries to punch the ball out of Wilt's hand. Instead, he punches him on the broken hand. And then Tommy's like, whoa, he's going to kill me. And then he's like, if I play chicken with this guy right now, he's going to own me. So he gets to the foul line, keeps looking at me. They do a stare down. And then Tommy said, I kept looking at him right in the eye. I put my hands on his hips, on my hips, and I just kept staring at him. Finally, he said out loud to himself, this guy's crazy. And so he took the free throws, and then he basically, like, never had a moment of trouble with Wilt. You know, Wilt just kind of like – one of those Wilt things where it's just kind of like, man, this guy isn't even really worth my time. And, you know, whether you think it's like one of those psychological things of the Celtics getting in Wilt's head and, like, not – you know, him not being intense enough or whatever, or if it's just like one of those things of just like the burden of being a superstar. But yeah, I thought that was a good story.
That is cool. Yeah, I like the stare down. Ah, you're crazy. Forget you.
Yeah. it's
good. Yeah,
forget about it. But yeah.
There you go. Well, now we're going to go to next game here is supposedly recent history, but believe it or not, right. 2019 was actually 20 years ago. Because 2020 actually was seven years in one. This actually, yeah, it's hard to believe that May 12th, 2019 was not that long ago. But good Lord, does it feel like so long ago. And also just because the NBA and the things around it have changed so much in that time as well. Not only, you know, our lives, but also the league. It's game seven of the 2019 Eastern Conference Semifinals. Kawhi Leonard of the Toronto Raptors, his last second shot that bounces off the rim four times before eventually falling and giving the Raptors the 92-90 victory over the Philadelphia 76ers, gets them to the Eastern Conference Finals. Just to kind of lay out what was going on at this time, your key Sixers, Joel Embiid, Jimmy Butler, Ben Simmons, Tobias Harris, J.J. Redick, James Ennis, Mike Scott, your 2019 Raptors, Kawhi Leonard, we'll talk about how he comes to the team here in a bit, Marc Gasol, Kawhi Leonard, or Kyle Lowry, Pascal Siakam, Danny Green, Serge Ibaka, Fred VanVleet, all those sort of guys. So, LeBron moves to Los Angeles, you know, start this year off, and the East is open. And it appeared that, you know, these two teams, along with Milwaukee, were probably the three teams most poised to take over that Eastern, you know, Conference crown. And that'd be true for one of the teams that I mentioned, but not the other two. So, because only one team could be the conference champion. Anyway, the Raptors, they make a huge trade in the offseason. They decide to trade franchise stalwart DeMar DeRozan to San Antonio for disgruntled, soon-to-be free agent Kawhi Leonard. It is a big deal because it's the Raptors breaking up the core of DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry. That was a good core. They won, you know, 50-odd games for, you know, a bunch of years, three straight years. They win 50 games. They get to the conference finals. They get to the conference semifinals. They couldn't get over the hump, though, so the team decides to try something new. And this is a big deal. You have DeMar DeRozan, who's been with that franchise forever, drafted by the franchise, had been with them, through the thick and thin, and had a great relationship with everybody, including Kyle Lowry, all that sort of stuff. They trade him for a guy who basically, in no uncertain terms, is like, probably not going to re-sign with this team, by the way. They go, well, we'll see. We'll figure out what's going to happen. And they win one fewer game than they did the year prior, but it doesn't matter because Kawhi brings a superstar presence to the team that wasn't quite there in years prior. Additionally, though, and I think this is just as much as, you know, getting Leonard, I think this was a huge part of it as well. Toronto starts assembling a core of really, really good young role players. And really what they do that no team at this time was really doing nearly as much is building and developing guys through their G League, the former D League, the G League, and building people up through there. And that's where, you know, the coach Nick Nurse comes from the G League. He's coached a lot of these guys that have been sort of picked up off the scrap heap, brought to the G League, developed, and now they're ready for the NBA. And that's where a lot of their guys, you know, come from. And it really kind of sets them apart from a lot of other teams in the league, is that they are very, very deep, very talented, and more than anything, you know, I hate to use the term, but they were a team in so many ways, because, you know, this is in the peak years of Kawhi Leonard, you know, kind of sitting back-to-backs out, sitting games out, the before we knew the term, well, I think we knew, do we know the term load management at this point? I think we did. Was the term that they used for him. I forget. But whether it was developed this year or people knew about it the year prior, it was a very much a load development year for Kawhi, and they were like just perfectly fine without him. Like, they won, I think, as many games with him as they won without him, because right. the rest of the team and the rest of the core was just that good and that talented and had that sort of dynamic together. So Toronto, they make the playoffs. They make quick work of Orlando, winning in five games. Though I think I remember that Orlando won, I think, the first game of that series, and people were like, oh, here we go. And I remember that, and it's just like, no, it's Orlando. Like, they're not going to do this. And they didn't. So then they move on to the semifinals against Philadelphia. So
right. I know you're going to get into it here, but it is really interesting. If you look at the two paths the team took toward like developing their young players and like adding on into their core, you know, there's interesting contrasts and similarities here in you know, how they would build these rosters.
Absolutely. Because, for Philadelphia, this year's really, I'd say, kind of the culmination of the process in a lot of ways, because they're led by draft picks Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, you know, two guys that were drafted during, you know, the peak process years. And the Sixers are ready to make that leap and officially kind of kick open their competitive window. They, you know, obviously have three straight years of winning less than 20 games. Then they have a 28 and 54 record in the first year that they were kind of quote-unquote trying to win, sort of. And then they emerged the year prior to this, and they win 52 games. They make it to the Eastern Conference semifinals. In 2019, though, things are finally different, and here's kind of the next step of the quote-unquote process. Here is where, you know, you have your Joel Embiid, you have your Ben Simmons, you have your high draft picks, your top two, top three, top four, you know, draft picks or whatever, and now they also use a bunch of other assets that they have to acquire Jimmy Butler and Tobias Harris, two guys to kind of bolster the rotation. And this is what, you know, the process is about. It's about asset acquisition and, yeah, getting the draft picks, but then combining those with stars to help win a title. And that's what the goal was here. They emptied out the holster to try to get, you know, they got Tobias Harris, traded a bunch to get him. They got Jimmy Butler, traded a bunch to get him. This is what it's all about. The team wins just 51 games, but they were deeper than they had been years prior. Obviously, with that, you know, the four top guys there, Butler, Harris, Simmons, and Embiid, plus, you know, a decent role, rotation of guys as well at the bench, like a J.J. Redick that we mentioned, and Mike Scott and some other guys. I like that. So this series is about as even as it's going to be. They split the first two games 1-1. They split the next two. They're 2-2. Then you guessed it. They're 3-3. And that leads us to this game seven. And they're as evenly matched as they can be until the final seconds of this game seven, because this is a late 90s, early 2000s throwback game. Neither team shoots particularly well. Embiid has 21 points on just 6 of 18 shooting. Butler was 5 of 14 from the floor and just 1 of 6 from 3. Ben Simmons, he only took 5 shots, because that's kind of what Ben Simmons does in these types of games. And he has 13 points and 8 rebounds, so he does Ben Simmons things. Toronto, despite Leonard probably leaving in free agency after the year, they don't care. They're going to ride and die with their offseason acquisition. And in this game in particular, Kyle Lowry struggles. He has 4 from 13 from the field. For only 10 points. And Leonard is an absolute one-man show. He scores 41 points on 16 of 39 shooting, including this final shot of the game and the final shot of the series. It's tied at 90-90, and this is as simple of a play. We're gonna talk about some intricate plays, some intricate kind of developments in the rest of this episode. This is as simple as it gets. Marc Gasol inbounds it to Kawhi. Kawhi runs to the corner towards the baseline. Ben Simmons is guarding him. Eventually, as Leonard runs to the corner, the Sixers clearly are ready for this, because Joel Embiid picks him up at the corner. Leonard launches. Embiid is inches away from blocking it. It's 90-90, as we said. The ball hits the rim, and this arena is silent as you hear a dunk. And then it bounces again. Again. And then again, one more, a fourth time, before finally falling in as the arena, the city of Toronto, Canada explodes in ecstasy. Toronto is moving on to the conference finals, and it's in our recent history here, but I think this will be one of the more iconic shots and moments in NBA history, just because of just everything going on with it, the crowd exploding at home, the four bounces, all that sort of stuff. I mean, this is one we were going to see for the rest of our lives, this highlight. And Kevin Harlan with a great call here, who just says game, series, and Toronto has won. So Toronto moves on. They would, of course, defeat Milwaukee in the conference finals and then upset the Golden State Warriors to get the first NBA championship in franchise history. And then, as we mentioned, Kawhi does leave in free agency in Philadelphia. They don't reach this high ever again. They have some other issues along the way as well. We don't know what the future holds for Philadelphia. And Toronto's kind of bad now, but that's all right. They got the title.
Yeah, they got the title. Yeah, they'll take that trade off any time for sure. You know, I was looking at the rosters here, and normally this is a sign of a bad team, but I think with the modern, with the two-way contracts, we're going to be seeing a lot more of this. But 26 players played for the Sixers.
I know. I looked that up earlier. I was like, what the hell happened?
Well, I mean, the Raptors are 22. Yeah. Well, you know, they have, of course, they have the big trade for Butler. And Butler came to the Sixers in kind of similar circumstances as Leonard did to the Raptors. I mean, Butler was, he's going to be a free agent. He was disgruntled in Minnesota, even though they played pretty well, but he was not happy there. You know, they traded some of the key, the process guys, Covington and Saric. That was, about 15 games into the season or so. So, it was an early season trade, but it was quite at the beginning of the season. So, yeah, they had a lot of guys there. Like, they had, like, 3 games of Greg Monroe, and then he played on their playoff roster. Like, they had some interesting.
You don't remember the Greg Monroe Philadelphia 76ers era?
This was the Markel Fultz rookie year, that whole drama. You know, they had Shake Milton. They had Boban. They had Wilson Chandler. They had all kinds of guys.
They had guys. Yeah, they were certainly a team of guys.
They had a lot of guys, yes. So, but yeah, there's again, that would normally be a team, in tumult, and they certainly did have a little bit of, there was some drama that year with the team, but obviously they played really well, and came extremely close to making it to the Eastern Conference Finals. I mean, I remember watching that moment live, and just it was, my jaw dropped when that ball bounced in after after 4 times bouncing off the rim.
If you want to watch the highlight, I think the thing that stands out to me is that when it first hits, there's nobody making any noise. You hear, boom.
It's so
loud. Yeah. Nobody makes a sound. There's not one person screaming or yelling or clapping or whatever. Everyone's just like, let's see. And then you just hear it go, boom. And you're just like, what? Right. And then each subsequent bounce, like, more and more people are like, huh? It's like, they're slowly inflating, and then by that fourth bounce, some of the people are like, wait a minute, this might go in, and then it's not until it actually goes in that this crowd explodes. But an awesome moment. There's awesome photos from this thing too. I mean, this is just like an all-time great NBA shot and NBA moment. But it's always funny because I always forget that it was just for the semis,
right?
Like, I don't know, some part of me always thinks, because it was such a big deal, if you're like, oh, that's, and it's like, no, they just won like the semis, which is cool. But it was a great series, and a great moment and a great buzzer beater.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the only game 7-1 on here. I mean, if you're considering like the stakes and, like what it meant, it might be, the most important one that we have on our list. If you're kind of thinking about it in terms of circumstances, in terms of how it like shaped, the rest of the playoff series, this might be the biggest, most dramatic one, on this list. So, next one would not be the most dramatic one, because it was one on
the least
on free throws. Yes. This is JoJo White's 1974 NBA Eastern Conference semis, or in game 6, Buffalo Braves taking on the Boston Celtics. The Braves, young up and coming roster. They kind of had like, team of the decade possible vibes, going in. Really, that would really kick in the next year when McAdoo would take an MVP leap, and they really had, but they had, they had some really, a great young players, Jimmy McMillan, Randy Smith, Ernie DiGiorgio, and then a couple veterans like Gar Hurd and Jack Marin, to kind of round things out. The Celtics, 56-26 that year, Havlicek, Dave Cowens, Paul Silas, Don Chaney, Don Nelson, Paul Westphal being kind of the key young player there, kind of the, otherwise it was sort of the usual suspects from the, early to mid 70s teams. The year before they'd actually won 68 games, but fell in the playoffs due to a John Havlicek injury. Or if you believe New York Knicks fans, just because the Knicks were better. But anyway, regardless, yes. So, this is actually the second buzzer beater of the series. A more dramatic one, but less series, not a series clincher, was McMillan actually tipping in a McAdoo miss to win game 4 in Buffalo, which tied the series. And then, as we said, this one is less exciting. Ending a game with free throws with no time on the clock, it's kind of like kissing your sister. I don't know. I don't have a sister, so
I don't either. I'm an only child, so I can't.
Same here.
Yes, oh yeah, right, right. Child. So we can't. Yeah, so, but I imagine it's probably like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Anyway.
Or it just sucks. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. What time is kissing your sister would suck? I don't know. Probably.
It's really not. It's really not the best metaphor. Actually, I'm not really sure why I used it, but I guess it's just common one. Anyway, so let's move on. Yes. So. The and Boston really, like, and particularly Don Nelson, really choked the game away here. So They're up by four with 30 seconds left. And then Nelson, I think, got a rebound. But then Jack Maron stole the ball from him directly, gave it to McAdoo for an easy score. And then with 10 seconds left, McAdoo actually steals the inbound pass from Don Nelson with 10 seconds left. So it's a two.
Yeah, what are you doing, Don?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, smoking too much of the ganja there, I guess. Right. Yeah. You know, you got to have your head in the game. You know, not what you're doing after the game. But, yeah, so 7 seconds left. You know, Celtics have the ball. You know, Havlicek gets the inbounds. He takes a jumper. McAdoo blocks it. The ball goes to White. And then McAdoo ends up blocking his shot, but he draws a whistle with the contact, and there's 0 seconds left on the clock. So the call, I don't know, a little, I mean, it was
sucks. Definitely that a little contact. Terrible. But, yeah. But no, you watch the highlight, and it's like,
yeah,
like, you got to swallow the whistle in that moment, right? Like, unless he's knocked down, like, come on, what are we doing?
Exactly. So it's funny because so what we watched, it was like a 4 minute clip of just the highlights of the series. And it's Johnny Most who's narrating it. So Johnny Most, of course, is, you know, the Celtics announcer, the biggest Celtics homer everywhere. So, you know, they show clips of Jack Ramsey exploding. But the reason that Johnny Most gives is saying there should have been one second on the clock. But I'm pretty sure he also was not happy about the clock.
Yeah, so. I'm sure he's not like, God damn it, put a second back on that clock. I'm sure he was also like, are you, right.
Yeah, are you kidding me with that? Yeah, so.
Anti-Buffalo, you know, they killed this franchise. God damn it, the NBA.
Right, exactly. The refs
too scared of Buffalo being the preeminent spot in the NBA and in the country. And
they just couldn't handle it, that's what happened in the Super Bowl all those years, too.
Yeah, right, you know? Exactly.
So,
right.
Yes. So, this is actually happens in Buffalo. So you cannot blame the notorious Boston Garden scorekeepers, you know, for the clock shenanigans at this time. That would happen on occasion. Of course, if that had actually happened, there probably would have been at least, if this had happened in a more recent season, there probably would have been at least a few, you know, milliseconds left on the clock. Maybe, you know, Buffalo would have been able to get a shot with, you know, 0.5 left or whatever, you know, but obviously that wasn't the case during this time. And of course, if this happened today, there would have been like 50 replays of the foul and every other
45 minutes. And we wouldn't really even care by the end. We'd just be like, all right, I got other things to do. Can we get on with this? Let's see what Steve Jammy has to say. I don't really care.
Yeah. Like, we love it. Yeah. I do think my one like old man yells at cloud complaint about the NBA is that I would just get rid of instant replay. I'm fine with some calls.
Yeah,
being
I'm
wrong.
With you. I'd rather have things be wrong occasionally than to sit there for 45 minutes and watch the back of two referees as they, you know, point, you know, rub their chins, and then Steve Jammy goes, "Well, I think this is going to be a foul," and then they say, "It's not a foul." He's like, never right ever. It's just right. Like that. Just Jeff Van Gundy's complaining about something. It's terrible.
Right?
It's the worst.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. Jeff Van Gundy's another one that. Like, I mean, I don't like Jackson either, but I honestly, like, of the two, I dislike hearing Jeff Van Gundy worth. Jeff Van Gundy might taste smarter than he's more. Yeah. Well. Yeah. I mean, I don't want either one there, but you know, of the two, I honestly. Yes, Van Gundy is the more annoying to me.
Give me Steve Snapper Jones, baby. That's what.
There you go. Yes. So, okay. And they don't show him the highlights either. But according to the recap of the game, White actually did miss the first free throw. But at this point, you have three chances to make two. So he hit the next two, which as per the rules of the time. So the selective video editing there to make. To make JoJo White seem more clutch than he actually was because he missed the first one. So,
You know, that's all because they do say, like in this clip that we saw, it's on YouTube, I think it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
As well. They're like, JoJo White's got ice water in his veins and he just sinks both shots. And, but he missed the first one. Like,
not quite. Yeah, that's kind of important. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I guess it wasn't. I mean, I guess it didn't matter in the end, but it's just funny. Yeah, they were like, JoJo White, always solid. You know he's going to make all these shots, and he does. The end.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Game over.
It's like when we learned the 88 dunk contest when Jordan actually missed the first dunk and they never show the video. It's like, exactly. So. Yeah, so anyway, the Braves fans and their owner, not so happy about it. There's a New York Times recap of the game, and it says, Paul Snyder, he followed by many fans, ran straight for the officials' dressing room to protest the lost call. Police held the angry ground about 30 feet from the room, but Snyder got there. He opened the door, and he loudly registered his anger with Mendy Rudolph and Daryl Gerritsen. Finally, the referees were able to close the door. Snyder stormed off. and then unable to change the, you know, the outcome of the series. Tom Heinsohn, the Celtics coach, says, "I think that was a hell of a gutsy call." So,
Heinsohn thought it was a good idea. Yeah, good,
yeah.
Good call.
Hey, I thought it was great. Gutsy, yeah, great call. Gutsy call. Very gutsy call. So, yes, White in the game finished with 18, 3 and 3. Havlicek at 30, 10 and 7 assists. McAdoo had 40 points and 15 rebounds in the loss. And though, you know, it's not going to officially count on the list because it was not a game-winning buzzer beater. Of course, Gar Hurd played for the Braves here 2 years later with the Suns, but in a pretty famous buzzer beater on his own, maybe in a, you know, a double overtime against this very same Boston team, of course, minus Paul Westphal, in game 5 of the NBA Finals. So some
revenge for him. Yeah. But not everybody else, unfortunately.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Right.
Our next game, we're going to go over this one pretty quickly, because if you listen to our first episode, we hinted at this. This is Michael Jordan.
Yeah, it's against the Cleveland Cavaliers. Rich, I believe that's Mikael Jordan.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah, Rodrigo Blas, friend or cousin. I forget what we said.
Yeah, right.
Mikael Jordan or Mikael Jordan. Yeah. 1993 Eastern Conference semifinals. We talked about this one. It's a lot of the same players, a lot of the same things. It's less heartbreaking, but it is still kind of the same unfortunate scenario here. It's Michael Jordan. It's the Cavaliers. The 1993 Cleveland Cavaliers. We talked about they had kind of fallen on some hard times after that first Jordan shot, but then got things back together. It's a little bit of a different core. It's Brad Doherty. It's Gerald Wilkins, Larry Nance, Mark Price, Craig Elo is still there, Hot Rod Williams. But they get some young guys as well. They got Terrell Brandon in there. They have Danny Ferry. So it's a reloaded team. It's got some of the same names, but it's also got some good young talent as well. And then the 93 Bulls, they're 57-25. They have Jordan, they have Pippen, they have Horace Grant, B.J. Armstrong, Bill Cartwright, Scott Williams, John Paxson, Stacey King. They are the two-time defending champions at this point, too. So this is way less dramatic than that first shot. Yes, that first shot happened in the first round, but it is iconic and people remember it forever. This one, it's in game 4. It's way less dramatic. Cleveland is down 3-0. They're a good team, but I mean, come on, these are the two-time defending champion Chicago Bulls, and there's really no doubt that if Jordan misses this shot, like, the series is probably still going the way it's going to go. The Bulls are probably going to win this one. The score is tied at 1-1, and it's pretty easy, and the clip that we have is awesome. I believe it is from the Cleveland Cavaliers, and I don't know who the commentators are, but the ball comes into Michael Jordan, and this announcer is just like, "You got to get after him. Got to get after him. Get him off the ball. Get him off the ball." And they don't. The Cavaliers just go, "You know what, Gerald? You got this one." It's Michael Jordan against Gerald Wilkins. Gerald Wilkins, to his credit, almost steals the ball. He pops it out. Then Jordan backs him down, and then just turns around for an 18-foot fadeaway and wins 103-101. And the Cavaliers announcers aren't even, like, surprised or upset. They're just like,
right.
I mean, you got to bring some other guys to him. They don't they don't double team him. They don't try to get him off the ball. They don't, like, nobody comes at him. They're just like, "Gerald, it's Michael Jordan. I bet you can defend this guy. I don't know about it."
It's
Michael Jordan in 1993. Like, he's probably going to hit the shot, and he's done it over you before. So,
The funny thing about it is the 89 shot is so, like, young Michael Jordan, and this 93 one, he wasn't quite old Michael Jordan yet, but it's a very, very old Michael Jordan shot. It's very slow. It's an 18-foot fadeaway. It develops so slowly. He doesn't really jump that high, you know, with the first shot. I mean, he just jumps so incredibly high. It so incredibly shows that athleticism. And then 93, it's much more like the, you know, the older Jordan that we'd see, you know, later on in the 90s.
Yeah. The last three-peater, the Wizards Jordan, where he's just like,
in that same vein, it's much more, you know, even though it's only 4 years later, it looks like a much different Michael Jordan. Maybe not quite reflective of what he was at that time, but definitely reflective of what he would be later on. Yeah.
He doesn't get the shot because of athleticism. He gets the shot just because he's crafty and good on the block and good on the elbow and great at the turnaround jumper. And that would become the shot that he'd win three more championships pretty much just doing this shot every single game, constantly. So it's very strange, the commentary, though. They're just like, well, that's what's gonna happen when you don't double team Michael Jordan. You leave Gerald Wilkins on him, and that's what happens. And what's part of the tragedy, though, like you said, it's a little less dramatic, but it is still very tragic. Craig Elo barely misses a jumper, barely, just to put the Cavs ahead with 18 seconds left. He misses it. He doesn't, of course. And Michael Jordan comes back down and then scores. And Craig's just like, all right, man, I don't know. Like, I don't know what to do anymore. So it is what it is. But this is probably famous, you know, mostly because this is Lenny Wilkins' last game as Cavs coach. They would transition to a new era after this. And they would lose to a Michael Jordan-less Chicago Bulls the next year in the first round, which had to just be even more tragic. Like, all right, we got rid of Wilkins. That was the problem. Wait, they don't have Jordan anymore? Oh, okay, we're good. Then it's like, nope, nope, Scottie Pippen's still good too. We're still going to lose. So, yeah, then they would be bad for a while. They'd have terrible jerseys. And then, well, then they'd be bad for a little bit more, and then they'd get Sean Kemp. And they'd be bad for a little bit more, and then they'd get LeBron James. So,
The next season, so Elo was gone after the next season. And then Doherty and Nance, I think, both get hurt the next season, and basically their careers are done early. And then Price is gone pretty soon afterward, and the Hot Rod Williams is gone pretty soon. Yeah, so this was pretty much, I mean, they had one more year that was kind of a little bit of a transition year. And they, of course, they ended up losing to the Bulls in the first round the next year without Michael Jordan. It was, you know, Scottie Pippen fells them that time, or whoever. I don't think there were any dramatics in that series in particular, but even without Jordan, they're still losing to the Bulls in the playoffs. But yeah, there really was kind of the last gasp of any chance of the Cavs, being a deep playoff team. And they'd actually at the regular season, they were, similar record and a slightly better SRS. So regular season quality, they looked even. Of course, that was on paper, the third year of a three-peat to the Bulls. Probably not trying to start in the regular season as they had previously. So, what was showing on paper wasn't quite what it was. But, yeah, if you look at that team, in a normal year, that Cavs team probably has a chance of making a deep playoff run. But, again, Michael Jordan.
Yeah, that'll happen to them, so. There you go.
Yep. There you go. All right. So next we're moving on to the conference finals. We have two instances here in the conference finals. The first one, Ralph Sampson. Ralph Sampson, kind of had a reputation, at least in the pros, of not always stepping up in, the big moments. And some of that would be how he played in the 86 finals. But man, he delivers here. This is May 21st, 1986. Game five, it is the Rockets against the Lakers. Of course, the Lakers had been the champs in 85. They'd made the finals, I think six out of the last 7 years. The only year they didn't make it was in 81, where the Rockets actually made it to the finals that year, having upset the Lakers in the playoffs. Yes, the Lakers and Rockets are tied at 112. 1 second left. The ball is at half court. You've probably seen the footage. Sampson just gets the ball, hits a dramatic turnaround. Another one where the ball, it hits off the rim and it just bounces right in. Really a dramatic moment. Rockets go crazy. Of course, this was the Rockets would win this series 4-1. But it was sort of like, even though, it was at a point in which, like, the Rockets were clearly ahead, it felt like it was the Lakers. Like, the Lakers still, like, had a shadow of hope here, even, and I would have just put them down 3-2. Certainly, other teams have come back from a 3-1 lead. But even though it might have felt like, oh, yeah, the outcome was inevitable, even if Sampson doesn't make this, I think the aura of the Lakers at the time made it feel like, are the Rockets really going to do this?
Yeah, and we'll talk about it here in a bit because, yeah, the teams are on, like, two completely different paths at this time. Like, the Rockets are still kind of new and fresh, and they got two young players and a good core of guys. But, like, yeah, it's the freaking Lakers, and, like, nothing changed either. Like, it's the same Lakers team that won the title the year prior, and it's got Magic, and it's got Kareem, and it's got Worthy, and it's got Scott, and it's got Rambis. And they're all still good, and they're all still, it's like everything that team was. I mean, nothing really changed about the Lakers. So it's like, yeah, you could totally see that if this bounces out, the Lakers probably go, all right, cool, good. We're good. Like, there'd be almost no doubt. And it almost seemed like even at the end, it was just kind of like the Lakers, they weren't like devastated. They were just kind of like, oh man, what? Like, how did that happen?
Yeah,
like,
how did that happen?
And it's so weird. The series is just like, yeah, they win game one, which we'll talk about in a bit. And it feels like, all right, well, here we go. Lakers going to, do it again. And then what's weird though, is there's this year is a blip because what's going to happen the next 2 years is the Lakers going to win the finals because they're great.
Right.
And they're the Lakers. So they win the year prior. They lose this game in this series, and they get, like, beaten pretty good by the Rockets. The Rockets just come in here and beat them. And then I don't know if it was just, like, a wake-up call to them, but, yeah, they go in the next 2 years. But, it's a great point by you that it feels like at no point like the Rockets should win this series, and it felt like at any point the Lakers could win the series, and then they just didn't, and the Rockets just won 4-1 on this shot.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only thing, you know, the only major change is, you know, again, Kareem's like 38 at this point. I mean, yeah, so he's, right. You know, he's getting older, but he was still, you know, really effective. Kareem, yeah. During the season. Yeah. And he had a couple of just awesome games against the same Rockets, like late in the season, like, you know, like 40 plus point games, you know, against Akeem, against Ralph Sampson, you know, so, you know, he was, you know, still pretty much kicking ass. I mean, you know, the numbers were down a little bit overall, but you know, there wasn't like a whole lot of like signs of like, oh, you know, Kareem's, you know, losing it, even though, yeah, that was kind of the thing. And they did transition a little bit away from, you know, being so focused on Kareem, you know, going forward. That have obviously helped them win the championships, even though he was still an important player for the team. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's still Magic. You know, James Worthy and Byron Scott are both, you know, really, you know, great young players, especially Worthy. You know, you saw Kurt Rambis, you got Michael Cooper, you got Maurice Lucas, you got Mitch Kupchak, who's in his last career game. But he goes out with a bang for sure. 86 Rockets, you've got Sampson, you got Hakeem Olajuwon, of course, Rodney McRae, Lewis Lloyd, and then two players left from the 81 finals team, Robert Reed and Alan Lovell. Mitchell Wiggins, who's Andrew's dad, and then Jim Peterson, who's now a TV analyst for the Timberwolves. So some fun names there. And as you said, you know, two teams, entirely different paths. The Lakers, you know, they'd won titles in 80, 82, and 85 the previous season, you know, made the finals in 83 and 84 as well. So, you know, and then during the season, yeah, they'd won 62 games in back-to-back seasons going into the series. So yeah, there was really no sign of slippage there, but you know, Houston, you know, after, you know, kind of that Cinderella story in 81, where they were like 42-40, but they made the finals. They, you know, ended up falling off a cliff. They lost Moses Malone. They won only 14 games in 83. You know, definitely not tanking, of course, because, you know, no one tanked.
No. Yeah. It just happened to
have to be bad. Go right,
from 40
right
wins to 19 wins. Yeah. Like, you know, that's our 14 wins, but no, definitely. I mean, it worked out great because they got exactly who they needed and wanted, Ralph Sampson with
them. Right. Ralph Sampson. Picks. Yeah. Who was like, I mean, Ralph Sampson was like, you know, like the, like, coveted.
Yeah,
like
there was no doubt who the number one pick was going to be that year.
Right. I mean, it was kind of like Tim Duncan, you know, 15 years later. I mean, it was definitely, he was just.
Are you insinuating like, the San Antonio Spurs maybe tanked as well? Get out of here. How dare
right,
you?
Like, right. Exactly. I mean, it was just like the one key guy that everyone knew was going to be able to, like, turn around, you know, the franchise. I mean, he'd been probably the most dominant college star since Kareem, you know. So, definitely that guy that you wanted. And then next year, you know, they were better. The Rockets, you know, they went from 14 to 29 wins, but they still actually ended up being one of the worst teams in the league. At that point, they did a coin flip with Portland to get the number one choice, and it ended up being Houston again, and they got Hakeem Olajuwon. So, yes, they had their new Twin Towers. 85, they went back to the playoffs. They won 48 games, but they actually lost in the first round of the Jazz. And then in 86, they won 50 games for the first time in franchise history. You know, Olajuwon averaged 23 points per game and 11.5 rebounds per game. Sampson, 19 points per game, 11 rebounds per game. So, you know, just and yeah, I mean, it wasn't 100% a perfect fit, but they, you know, they still played really well together. They had, you know, some really good vets rounding out their roster. And Craig Ela was on the team too. Didn't play in this game, but he was definitely on the roster. And so he didn't always, you know, get the short end of the stick of these buzzer beaters.
Yeah, I see. But, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, he sold his soul for this buzzer beater.
Right, and then, right.
Unfortunately, it was destined for a lifetime of heartbreak after this. But I got his one. So
yeah, maybe not the best choice.
That monkey paw. Yeah, he got one last wish on the monkey paw. And this is what he chose.
Sure.
Please let Ralph Sampson win. Get this
team winner. Yeah. I just love Ralph so much. Yeah, it's fun to win. Right. No. Yes. So. Yeah, the Rockets, you know, beat the Sacramento Kings in the first round. I think it was their first year in Sacramento, actually. And then they beat the Nuggets 4-2 in the second round to you know, face off against the Lakers there. The Lakers actually won game one of the series. Kareem had 31 points. Everything kind of seemed like it was good for them. And then game two. The Lakers, or excuse me, Houston won game two thanks to 40 and 12 from Kareem. That was in game three, 40 and 12 from Kareem in game three. And then Hakeem, you know, 35 points in game four. So they win both games in Houston. And then suddenly, like, oh, shit, we're a little bit in trouble. But, you know, the Lakers actually got a huge lead in the first quarter, up by 12. Houston wouldn't go away. And, you know, the Lakers, like, they played a good game. You know, their key guys all, you know, delivered well, you know, Worthy at 19. Kareem at 26 and 13. You know, Magic didn't have a good shooting night, but he had 24 and 13. But, yeah, the Rockets at that point just, you know, everyone kind of, got there. You know, Akeem at 30, even though, you know, Akeem, a key moment of this game is Mick Kupchak baits him into a fight. And, you know, the two get into a punching match. You know, there's a famous clip of, like, the referee, like, trying to get between them and basically, like, you know, diving on them and, like, and breaking them up. You know, Kupchak manages to get Akeem kicked out of the game, but, you know, the Rockets are still able to pull it off. You know, Robert Reed is 15, Lloyd is 15, McRae is 11 points and 11 assists. And the final of his 11 assists is, you know, the one that you that lives on in infamy. You know, basically, yeah, the Rockets inbound the ball all the way from the low block, which is, you know, kind of similar to the Derek McKee series winner that we talked about in the prior episode. It's just, it's a fluid motion. Samson leaps up and then kind of volleyball sets the ball up, and it goes straight into the basket. And then, yeah, it just, it goes in. The Rockets are off to the finals, and it's you know, the Lakers are, you know, and it's in LA. So, like, you know, the LA fans are just, you know, pretty much in shock of, you know, they're what looked like an invincible team, you know, falling off here. And yeah, it felt very much like an era defining thing just because of, like, okay, oh, wow. You know, Samson and Olajuwon are so young, you know, they're going to dominate the league forever. Didn't quite work out that way for various reasons, although obviously Olajuwon would, you know, have his dominant era, you know, later on in the 90s.
Yeah, it does feel like that. It does feel like, oh crap, like this team that just got, you know, two first overall picks, these two Twin Towers, they just upset the Lakers. Like this felt like this was going to be the start of this dynasty. And yeah, even though things are going to happen in the finals and they're going to lose to the Celtics, this felt like the beginning of the dynasty and not necessarily just this kind of weird blip in the radar that would that would happen with Houston. And that's unfortunately what does happen is, you know, Ralph Sampson battles injuries. Hakeem is, you know, great, but not good enough to kind of let this, you know, get this team to the top. And yeah, it's going to be another decade until this team actually truly reaches the potential or the potential that people thought they were going to see here. But yeah, it's a very interesting thing. It's very similar to the buzzer beater we saw this year, the Valley Oop thing with DeAndre Ayton and Jay Crowder, where it's just, right. you wonder what the Lakers were guarding. Because, like, McRae's just able to get the ball into Ralph Sampson on the block, and then it's like, well, why are you guarding anybody else? Like, there's just no point in, like, there's 1 second left. Like, there's not much more that can happen besides a tip-in. But, yeah, they get caught, I don't know, and then, yeah, Ralph just taps it in. And maybe they just thought there's no way he's going to get this in 1 second. He can't even do a real shot, so we'll just, you know, make sure that we're close to somebody. But, yeah, it's a remarkable shot, a remarkable pass, and a really cool moment for the Houston Rockets. And, like you said, this is one that kind of rules that it's at home. Or at home for the Lakers and on the road for the Rockets, because it is that stunned silence that happens right. as we see the shot happen. Well, hey, I guess that transitions very well into the 1997 shot we're going to talk about here, which is also features the Houston Rockets and another stunned silent arena as John Stockton in the Western Conference Finals on May 29th, 1997, Game 6. John Stockton hits a three at the buzzer, lifting Utah over Houston 103-100. To win the series 4-2. And as far as, you know, the Jazz and the key players here, like it has been for the last decade plus, Malone and Stockton, head coach Jerry Sloan, they had some guys around them this year and really kind of helped them get to this level that we're going to talk about in a bit. Byron Russell, Jeff Hornacek, Greg Ostertag are your big guys. And they pretty much play their core five or six guys 40 plus minutes a game, like, because they're not really in a whole big desire to get Adam Keefe, you know, into the game. So it's, yeah, you know, it falls off pretty quickly here. So they're like, hey, you know what, Malone, you're good, man. 48, you're good. You got that. Stockton, hey, same deal. So it's pretty much a five or six man team at this point,
right.
And things would not change in 98. They would, you know, a little bit more minutes for Antoine Carr, you know, in 98, right. But it's essentially that core again that's going to do it the next year. But that's the 97 Jazz. The 97 Rockets, though, and we'll talk about them in a bit here, very interesting team here. You have Akeem Olajuwon, who is still with the team, obviously. Clyde Drexler, who came over in 1995, is still with the team. They do acquire Charles Barkley. We'll talk about that in a bit. He's a big part of this. Mario Elie, Matt Maloney, Cedale Threet, Eddie Johnson, and Kevin Willis are also members of this 97 roster, the Rockets team. But
old guys. I mean, I guess both teams have a lot of old guys.
Very old. Yeah, and I was going to say, this is really a huge this is the matchup between two of the best teams of the decade. You obviously have the Rockets with two titles, and you have the Jazz, who were consistently great throughout the decade. But it's like, their competitive windows are very close to being shut. It's like every key player in the series is like 36 years old or older. It's pretty wild how old you know, these two teams are, but still very, very good. The key here is going to be for the Rockets is in the offseason they acquire Charles Barkley, and that is an interesting trade that actually ended up being pretty horrendous for Phoenix. So what happens is August 19th, 1996, Phoenix Suns trade Charles Barkley with a second-round pick. It was kind of meaningless second-round pick to the Houston Rockets, and the package they get back is Chucky Brown, Mark Bryant, Sam Cassell, and Robert Horry. So Chucky Brown, Mark Bryant, just kind of dudes, you know what I mean? Just guys that wasn't really anything. Sam Cassell, who was young, you know, kind of a good role player for the early Rockets, he's traded midway through the next season. So Phoenix barely hold on to Sam Cassell. They move him to Dallas pretty quickly after that. And then the Robert Horry thing, Jason, I would say probably does not go very well, as he would very soon after this throw a towel in the face of your favorite player, coach, and executive, Danny Ainge, who was the head coach of the Phoenix Suns at this time. So Robert Horry, the run doesn't work very well. And yeah, I know that like Charles Barkley's value is probably pretty low in 1996, and especially with all the issues and the turmoil going on between him and Phoenix. But man, that's a pretty bad package for a guy who was still a pretty damn good player. But yeah, that's it's the Suns.
Yeah, well, right. Yeah, I mean, I like Horry and Cassell actually, like, it's not. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's no huge star there. I mean, Cassell is the closest thing to a star, and randomly don't keep him for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think it's a whole different trade if you keep Sam Cassell, because Sam Cassell was good, and Sam Cassell would end up becoming a good player. But they just, like, in 20 games, like, we got to get rid of this guy right away. It's like, okay,
right.
And then...
I mean, the Horry thing wasn't entirely their fault. I mean, you know, that was just whatever weirdness was going on with them. You know, you can't really predict that. But yeah. the Cassell decision seems very strange. So yeah, if they kept those guys and been able to like have them as part of like, you know, their like future team, and they'd be pretty good again fairly soon. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Like then that would have been like, okay, well, wait a minute. I do take it back, because wasn't Cassell part of the Jason Kidd trade?
That's right. Okay. So, you know, that's fine then. Yeah, right. That actually worked. That's a good time to trade Sam Cassell. Yeah, I forgot that he went. Yeah, it makes sense. He went to Dallas. Okay, that's cool. I would definitely trade Sam Cassell for Jason Kidd. That's fine.
Okay, so, right. Yes. So that was, yeah, so that actually makes sense. Yeah.
And then the Robert Horry thing was just like from day one. I think we talked about that in a prior episode. Pretty much from day one, he's like, I don't want to be here. This place sucks. And it doesn't go well. At any point for one Robert Horry, but that's fine. Anyway, things start going well pretty quickly for the Barkley and the Rockets. He has a career-high 33 rebounds in his first game with the franchise. Unfortunately, old age and I guess the shape of his body starts to finally rear its ugly head on Barkley as he battles injuries throughout the year. He does end the year 18.2 points per game and 12.8 rebounds per game, which is good. It's the most rebounds he's had since his very early days in Philadelphia, but it is his first year since his rookie year that he averages below 20 points per game. But with that said, he had always was kind of the dominant scorer on pretty much almost every team that he was on, and now he's joining a team that's got Hakeem Olajuwon, so you don't need Charles Barkley to score 25 points a game. You just need him to kind of chip in. So 18.2, not bad from Barkley, but the injuries are going to unfortunately be a part. He's going to miss about 20 or 30 games in the season. But the goal here was to reinvigorate the franchise, and it worked. Houston, you know, obviously had won the championship in 94 and 95, but they fell down to earth in 1996, only had a 48-34 record, and realizing that, hey, look, our guys are old. Hakeem is old. Clyde Drexler's old. If we're going to make this, if we're going to do anything with this core, we need to get, you know, to the next level here. And that's what they do with Charles Barkley. So they get Barkley, they get Drexler, they have Hakeem. It's a solid roster of role players. They win 57 games. They sweep the Timberwolves in the first round. They battle in a 7-game series with the Supersonics in the semifinals. And then they're going to battle here with the Jazz in the conference finals. And now, speaking of the Jazz, they had been great for the last decade. And we did a show about them in our early days. We talked about the second best team of the 90s. You know, obviously everybody knows about the Bulls, but who's the second best team of the 90s? And we made a case for both the Jazz and the Sonics as two great teams that always were in the mix, but just could never really get it together in the playoffs, and we just couldn't get to the NBA Finals. Because the Jazz, they win 54 games in 91, 55-92, 53-94, 60-95, and 55-96. And yet in that time, they made, you know, three conference finals, but no NBA finals. But they finally got over the hump. And Jason, you know why they got over the hump?
Because, because the other teams were slightly worse, and they and somehow Karl Malone managed to just be awesome even in his late 30s?
Nope. Prior to the 1996-97 season, the Jazz unveiled new branding, logos, and jerseys. They got those crappy, purple, nice, clean jerseys with the good logo. They got that shit out of there and said, no, man, we need purple mountains, baby.
So help me understand. So bad uniforms ruin the Rockets, but they help the Jazz.
Exactly,
because right?
if you're thinking about that, if you're wondering, man, when did the Rockets get their terrible jerseys? They got them in 1996. So yeah, they win two titles, then they get new jerseys. They fall off a cliff. They go to 48-34. But in this case, the Jazz, it was their secret power is purple mountains with blue writing over the purple mountains was exactly what this franchise needed. They needed more mountains, more snow-capped mountains. Yeah. And they got it. They got it here.
A follow-up. So what about the Sonics? Because the Sonics make the finals 1 year, with the bad jerseys, but then they end up, falling apart afterwards. Yeah. So were those a blessing and then a curse, or what happened there?
I mean, for me, a curse, I guess.
I mean, it was like a sell your soul to the devil type thing?
Yeah,
sort
of.
It's really
a tragedy here that from 96, 97, and 98, the Jazz and the Sonics, who have incredible jerseys and really great teams throughout the rest of the 90s, they don't make the NBA Finals until they get the absolute worst, dirt worst jerseys they can possibly have. Yeah. It's a tragedy that, you watch these highlight clips and you're just like, oh, gross. what are these things?
What the hell?
Although I think we might be on the other. I think the Sonics jerseys most people think are crappy, I believe. But I think a lot of people think these Jazz jerseys are cool, which I don't know. They're fine, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the three of the that we're talking about, they're the least. They're not as nearly as bad as the.
Oh, the Rockets are the most
as the Rockets or the Sonics ones. Yeah. I think the Jazz ones. I don't think they're good, but I think they're better. I do think they get a slight bump because they do sort of fit thematically.
The gaudiness fits
with Utah. And with the region. So yeah, and they're also, they're definitely a significant downgrade, but I don't think they're as significant of a downgrade as the other ones.
Well, it was the magic sauce here. It also helped that Karl Malone, he averaged 27.4 points per game, 9.9 rebounds, and 4.5 assists a game. MVP. He won MVP that year. So maybe that was part of it too, but I tend to think it's more the jersey. Well, he was inspired by the new jerseys. They made his muscles look great, let's be honest.
They did make his muscles look great. Yeah, I mean, Karl Malone was a creep, but he could play basketball.
Could lift weights, play basketball,
in the regular season. Yeah,
drive some trucks. I think.
So, yeah, you can drive some trucks.
And do the diamond cutter too.
He did the diamond cutter. That's true. Yeah.
He was named All NBA First Team, All NBA Defensive First Team. John Stockton, he averages 14.4 points per game, leads the league with 10.5 assists per game. Was named to All NBA Third Team and All NBA Defensive Second Team. Otherwise, Jeff Hornacek, he provides the team 14.5 points per game, second on the team in scoring. So. Not great, but hey, it's going to work when you got Karl Malone, the MVP, out there.
Yeah.
And then Byron Russell, he showed a lot of improvement as well. He stepped up his game, averages 10.8 points per game. Jazz win a franchise record 64 games this year as well. So they get off to a flying start in the Western Conference first round. They sweep the Clippers in three straight games. The Western Conference finals, they continue to roll. They beat the Lakers 4-1. And then Western Conference finals time, the Jazz take an early 2-0 series lead over the Houston Rockets, but the Rockets would get back on track. They'd win two games. The big one being the game four, where they got a buzzer beater against them, where Eddie Johnson, the Rockets forward, Eddie Johnson, it's a dramatic buzzer beater to win game four and get Houston back in the series, tie it up 2-2, and now we got ourselves a real series here. The Jazz take game five at home, and then game six would be another battle and appear to be heading to an overtime as the game is tied 100-100. With just seconds to go. In this game, Drexler has a huge performance, 33 points. Hakeem is quiet. He only has 16 points. And Charles Barkley gets 20 points, but has a pretty rough shooting night, at 5-13 from the field. The Jazz, well-rounded attack. Malone has 24, Russell has 15, Hornacek has 18. Greg Ostertag chips in 16 as well. But in the end, it was John Stockton's last 3 points that mattered the most. And this is a pretty cool play that the Jazz run here. They have Byron Russell inbounding it. Hornacek runs to the corner, and that gets some people's attention. Hey, man, Jeff Hornacek's out there in the corner. Who knows what's going to happen? Antoine Carr dives right to the rim. No one really cares that much about Antoine Carr. They're like, sure, right. Pass to Antoine Carr. That's fine. If Antoine Carr beats us, that's fine. Malone sets a screen, and then the NBC announcers, I believe it's Brian Gumbel here, just goes, uh-oh, as John Stockton is so open. There is nobody within 15 feet of him as he gets the inbound pass. He takes one dribble. Charles Barkley noticing, oh, shit, nobody's guarding John Stockton. That's not good. Somebody should go guard John Stockton. He runs out there, but he does not make it in time. Stockton is open. He takes one dribble, launches a three. It goes in. Stunned silence in Houston. The Jazz are jumping all over the place. They can't believe it. They have finally done it. They finally made the NBA Finals for the first time in franchise history. And all they have to do is defeat the defending champion, 69-win Chicago Bulls. So
yeah, I'm sure that went fine.
Yeah, you know what? Hey, they gave it a damn good effort that series. But
sure, yeah,
it doesn't happen. So yeah, so, after the game, they interview John Stockton. They say, hey, do you think you can beat the Bulls? And he just goes, we'll see.
enjoy this, dude.
Yeah, he goes, we'll see. They didn't think we could beat the Rockets. And I think it's kind of him being like, probably not, but whatever. Yeah, whatever. We're here. Like,
I can't say that.
I got a hat that says I won that Western Conference Finals. Like, I'm good, man. I got enough. It's fine. Right. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see.
Let me go do some investigation into viruses now. See how that goes. Yeah. Man, we lost Malone and we lost Stockton.
It's bad.
So, all right, I have a question. So Antoine Carr played 8 minutes and 22 seconds in this game. Why is he out there in the last play? I mean, he's fine. Like, he's a solid player.
Yeah, but yeah.
I'm assuming Ostertag was not out there. You know, they're looking for, they're probably looking for options for a shot, and then Antoine Carr is a better option for a jumper than Ostertag. It's what I'm guessing. I did not get a chance to watch the clip again before we did the show, so I'm just slightly surprised that
what I'm thinking they figured is that there's just pretty much no reason to have, like, so you like, the idea here is like, if this shot doesn't go in, it's like we're just going to, you know, it's just over. It's just done or whatever. So I guess you don't really necessarily need Ostertag in there, because he would just kind of, you know, you're going to get the rebound from him. But maybe they thought that if all else broke down, we could get it to Antoine Carr and he had a little bit more athleticism to just kind of grab it and put it in the rim or something. Yeah, I don't know. It's very strange, because he does not play very much. But then you're wondering, like, well, why not just put like Shannon Anderson or they had Howard Eisley at that. They had a lot of like good young players that could shoot from long range too. Like, those guys might all be better options than Antoine Carr. But man, they love themselves some Antoine Carr. So I can't.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. I mean, I love myself some Antoine Carr. I'm not denying the power of Antoine Carr. I'm just it does seem like you would have a guy who was in the rotation. But like I said, I mean, their starters played all more than 37 minutes in this game, and then the next most minutes is Shannon Anderson with 11 minutes 55 seconds. So the bench, they weren't going to these guys too much. So it's just
Greg Foster. Not much Greg Foster in this game. So
yeah, only 2 minutes of Chris Morris. So So I don't know. It's just interesting decision. Again, probably just because Antoine Carr is a better offensive threat than Ostertag here. You need a shot, any kind of shot, because it's a tied game. So, and they just happen to obviously Antoine Carr's gravity drew so much attention that nobody noticed John Stockton, and you know, John Stockton has an open shot. That's, you know, so I mean, Jerry's
it works.
What
can
I say? Yeah.
Yeah. Great, it's the call from NBC is incredible, as they just go, uh-oh. It's just there's just all this court. There's like 70 feet of John Stockton and then the rim, and there's nobody anywhere near him. And it's just like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Like, uh-oh. You know, I think it's, I Karl Malone sets the screen. I believe it's Mario Elie and Charles Barkley, and they just basically run into each other. And then Mario Elie goes like diving towards like Byron Russell, and it's like, maybe leave him alone. Like, I would leave Byron Russell alone and try to focus on John Stockton a little bit more. But
maybe. I don't know.
It ends up working well, but John Stockton does it, and they move on to the finals.
Good times. Yeah. All right. We are moving on. Our next show, we are going to look at some buzzer beaters in the finals. No game-winning buzzer beaters in the finals, but plenty of dramatic, interesting ones to discuss. So I think we're going to close our buzzer beaters series with that one, but that'll be next time. So hopefully everyone enjoyed this. Thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it. If you are into what we're doing and you want to support the show, whatever podcast app that you're listening on, go ahead and give us a rating and review. That helps people learn about us, gives us attention, and it makes us feel good about ourselves to see the good rating. So
absolutely, it's really just to boost our egos more than anything. So
yeah, which we'll definitely take at this point. You want to reach out to us? We are on Twitter and Facebook, both of those at Over and Back NBA, and you can find us. We are part of the Step Back at FanSided. So go to the Step Back. There's plenty of great NBA content there, both present and past. Richie's written some recent stuff there for looking at some of the historic matchups between the conference finals teams. So that's some great stuff there. We did some shows on that last year. Didn't get around to that this year, but there's some good content there. So great stuff. Everyone should check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, fansided.com's got that. We'll probably do some stuff as well when the finals, when we officially get our NBA Finals matchup ready. We'll look into some fun players that have played for both franchises, and that could be very fun too, especially with the teams that are left and stuff. Obviously, no playoff histories because most of these teams,
play
different conferences, so that would be tough. But hey, we'll see. It's not impossible that it could happen because the Bucks they had stops in the Western Conference in their day, so we'll see. We'll see what ends up happening if they make it through. So we'll have plenty of content up there at fansided.com, both in podcast and written form, for the remainder of the NBA season. So yeah, good stuff.
All right, cool. Well, thanks everyone for listening. We're back again soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.